Today, Jews around the world mark the High Holy Days, the 10 days of repentance, starting with Rosh Hashanah last week and ending this coming week with Yom Kippur. And as Unitarian Universalists, we respect and honor this Jewish tradition, as we did just now in this beautiful music. Often this time of year, I give a sermon on the theme of Yom Kippur, of making amends and forgiveness. However, this week, a big event in the religious life of the United States is the visit of the Pope to our country. Pope is in Cuba today, and soon he will be speaking in Washington, then New York, and then Philadelphia. Because there are so many Roman Catholics in our nation, this morning I want to reflect on this visit. 21% of adult Unitarian Universalists are raised in a Roman Catholic background, 21%. Nevertheless, our movement has had a history of hostility towards the Roman Catholic Church. It was our publishing house, Beacon Press, that for years published the writings of an outspoken critic of Catholicism, Paul Blandershard. In 1949, Blandershard, in a book published by Beacon Press, compared Catholicism with communism, saying that the two are, alas, as the two poles of the earth. They represent the same intellectual climate. On the one hand, the communists, and on the other hand, the Catholics. Authoritarian rule over the human mind. Well, times have changed, and some Unitarian Universalists remain critical of the Roman Catholics. One New England congregation voted not to light a chalice during the worship service, none of this stuff, because they said Catholics light votive candles during their services, and they did not want to be identified with the Catholics. A Unitarian Universalist minister in the Midwest was criticizing a colleague's worship service. He said it was too papist. I've never seen a Unitarian Universalist worship service attacked because it was too much like a Buddhist service or too much like a Jewish service. However, if our service of worship is too much like a Roman Catholic service, some of us feel uncomfortable. Now, the cost of the papal visit also raises complaints from us. The overtime for extra police patrols will be millions of dollars. The Catholic Church will pay for much of it, but not all of it. In Philadelphia, they've done a fundraiser for $45 million to pay for the Pope's two-day visit and the conference that they're having. This is the Catholics paying for most of the costs. But some of it is still paid by the local taxpayer. None of the cities or agencies involved have given specific estimates of how much it will cost. We do know, though, from 1995, a visit by Pope John Paul II cost taxpayers in the United States approximately $1 million a day, equal to perhaps $1.5 million today for security. Now, after this previous visit to the United States, a Unitarian Universalist minister, not me, because I'm not cynical or anything, a Unitarian Universalist minister wrote that he was delighted that the city had seen fit to spend millions of dollars on the visit of the head of the Catholic Church, and that the president of the Unitarian Universalist Association would soon be coming to town. He looked forward to the city spending an equal amount of money on that visit. The reply was that an equal amount of money would be spent when Unitarian Universalists have a membership of 69 million Americans. Of course, this Pope is different. In the words of James Carroll, writing this week in The New Yorker, this Pope is the accumulation of a slow, if jerky, recovery on the part of the church from its self-defeating rejection of modernity. In the 1970s in Berkeley, a priest said to me that the church will change from the bottom up. First, he said, the people in the congregations will change. He said, this is already happening with most American Catholics using birth control in spite of the prohibition. Then he said, the local priests will learn from their congregations, and they will change and become more tolerant and more modern. Then he said, eventually the old bishops will retire, will die, and these priests in the local congregations will be appointed and become bishops, and the bishops will change. And finally, he said, this will reach all the way up to the Pope. It will come from the bottom up in the church. And 40 years later, his prediction appears to be coming true. Francis is a step forward in the uneven progression of Catholicism as it leaves behind the Middle Ages and enters the 21st century. The Pope was born in Argentina in 1936, the eldest of five children. His father was an Italian accountant, and his mother worked at home, also from Italian roots. His father had left Italy for Argentina in 1929 to escape the fascist regime of Benito Mussolini. So the Pope began his childhood in a family where Italian was spoken at home and Spanish out in the world. As a young man in the 1950s, this future Pope worked as a bar bouncer and as a janitor sweeping floors. Regarding his life's calling, he said, when I was young, I would occasionally think about becoming a priest. But that was like how, as children, you think about being an engineer, or being a doctor, or being a musician. You see someone doing that profession, and you consider it. The Pope doesn't really explain why he became a priest. This is the closest he came to it in a description in a radio interview. It's more of an emotional description than a rational one. It was September 21st in the 1950s, he said. I always remember this. I went out for a walk with some friends, and I passed a church. I went inside the church. I entered. I felt that I had to enter. There are things you feel inside, and you don't really know what they are. I looked, and it was dark. It was a September morning, and I saw a priest coming. I didn't know him. He wasn't from that church. And then he sat down in the last confessional on the left, facing the altar. And then, I don't know what happened to me. I felt like somebody grabbed me from inside and took me to the confessional. I'm not sure what happened there. Clearly, I must have confessed. I don't know what happened. And when I finished confessing, I asked the priest where he was from, because I didn't know him. He said, I'm from an Argentine city near the border with Paraguay, and I am living near here in the rectory, and I'm going to lead Mass here occasionally. Then in the interview, the Pope recalled that the priest was suffering from leukemia and that he died the following year. The Pope said, while I was there, I felt that I had to become a priest, and I didn't doubt it. So he graduated from college. He had a degree as a chemical technician, and he went to work in the food section of a laboratory. He had a woman's boss, and people make much of the fact that this is the only pope in history that had a woman who was his supervisor, and she played an important part in his life later on. But he had this desire to enter seminary, and in 1958, at the age of 22, he did so. The church ordained him as a Jesuit priest in 1969 after long years of training. He was 32 years old. But he was a rising star among the Jesuits. Only 5 years later, officials appointed him to head the Jesuits in Argentina. It was the 1970s. Not an easy time, not an easy place to be a religious leader. And this period of his life is controversial for some folks. From roughly 1974 to 1983, the Argentine military government used security forces and right-wing death squads to hunt down and kill anyone who was believed to be associated with socialism. We don't know how many died, but the official estimate now is that at least 13,000 people disappeared. It was a time in which the military controlled everything. I had a friend who was living in Argentina, was born in Argentina, and grew up during that time and made his way to America. His name was Kevin, and we were talking one day, and he said, you know, my name really isn't Kevin. It was assigned to me by the government. People, when their children were born, were not allowed to pick the names of their own children by the military. The military had a list of names that were assigned to children. So my parents had a secret name for me that they could not use, and then Kevin became my official name. What a horrible country to live in, where they could not even choose the name of their own children. Now, Pope Francis's old boss, the woman that that supervised him and became his friend after his first job after college, when he worked in the chemistry lab and a food industry conglomerate. She lost, two of her children disappeared. And so she formed the organization that became famous in Argentina, Mothers of Disappeared Children. And they held vigils in Buenos Aires in Argentina during the dictatorship. She was picked up by the military police. She was tortured by the security services, and then she was dropped into the sea from an aircraft while presumably still alive. This was a woman who was close to the future pope. Some have criticized Pope Francis today. He was the highest ranking Jesuit in Argentina during this period, and they said he did not speak out against the military's abuse of power. His argument is that he was trying to protect the lives of the priests, to keep them from dying, so that they could survive and live on through this horrible time. He issued an order that the priests were to be neutral, to not engage in politics, and some of them resented this and ended up dying. 6 years as a leader in this environment was hard. After completing his term of office in 1980, he became the rector of the philosophical and theological faculty at San Miguel in Argentina. The military dictatorship finally ended in 1983 after the debacle of the Falklands War. Nearly 10 years later, in 1992, the Catholic hierarchy appointed the future pope as a bishop. Now, he was a very popular bishop, and part of his popularity was that he doubled the number of priests who were serving congregations in the slums of Argentina. But he did something else that made him popular among the common priests. He had a phone line installed in his rectory, in his office, which had an unlisted number that he only gave to the priests. And he said to the priest that he supervised as bishop, you may call me at any time. If you have problems, call me and talk to me. I am your minister. I will be your priest. And he made himself available. Sometimes when it was necessary, if a priest was elderly and sick and dying, he would go and sit with that person. This made him a very popular bishop, which is unusual for bishops. As a result for this good work, he was appointed a cardinal in 2001. 80% of the people in South America are Roman Catholic, and they have big families. Therefore, the South American Roman Catholic Church is growing more than any other part of the world. Consequently, when they were looking for a new pope, cardinals looked for a leader from this growing area, from South America. Now, the fact that Pope Francis's mother and father were Italian, and that Francis spoke fluent Italian from childhood without an accent, made him an attractive choice for a church still dominated by ethnic Italians. In Argentina, he had lived in a small apartment rather than the bishop's elaborate residence. He took public transportation, and he cooked his own meals. This simple lifestyle made him an attractive candidate, so his fellow cardinals elected him in March of 2013. He was 76 years old. Today, Pope Francis is in his third year leading the largest religious organization in the world as the leader of the 1,100,000,000 Catholics. The Pope has enormous power. In many ways, this Pope continues the policies that I and other religious liberals have disagreed with in the past. For example, although in responding to a question about overpopulation and the Church's ban on artificial birth control, the Pope said, quote, "Catholics should not feel compelled to breed like rabbits," unquote. Although he said this, the Church continues its prohibition against contraception, even among married couples. Because of the Pope's taboo on a particular form of conception, condoms, people are needlessly infecting themselves with AIDS. In the 1980s, as AIDS was getting more and more into our awareness, I had a friend who was a priest who worked for Rush Presbyterian Hospital in Chicago. And right after a renewed statement came from the church saying condoms were a sin and no one should use them and abstinence was the answer to AIDS, I asked this priest about this, a man who saw people dying on a regular basis of this horrible disease. And he said, "I feel like I'm part of an organization that is living in the Middle Ages." He was horrified by his own organization, and they continue this policy to this day. The New Testament, by the way, says nothing about ordaining women clergy. It doesn't say that it's a bad thing or shouldn't be done. Jesus never said, "Don't ordain women." So women have asked the Pope to admit women to the ranks of the Catholic clergy. He has given a firm no. In this policy, he continues an ancient practice of the Catholic Church, a practice which puts men in power over women. The Pope's position on abortion, it's only slightly softer than past popes. The Catechism of the Catholic Church says that a person who obtains an abortion, obviously a woman who obtains an abortion, incurs automatic excommunication, a penalty that can only be lifted by a bishop. Now, Francis has modified this slightly. On September 1st, he said, "The forgiveness of God cannot be denied to one who has repented." He added that he has met many women scarred by the agonizing and painful decision to have an abortion. So he's made a decision that for 1 year, there'll be a year of mercy. Starting in December, priests as well as bishops can lift the penalty of excommunication for women who confess to have had an abortion. A year of mercy. Well, my own view is very different. I believe that for some women, the decision to have an abortion is the most important, appropriate choice that a woman can make. No guilt should be involved because no sin has been committed. So on the one hand, when it comes to contraception, to women clergy, to abortion, I continue to disagree strongly with the Catholic Church. But on the other hand, in many ways, the Pope is changing the Church in ways that I find exciting. Earlier this month, he eliminated some of the bureaucracy and cost of obtaining an annulment. In the past, the Catholic Church leaders have excommunicated divorced couples. Francis has called for the Church to embrace Catholics who have divorced and remarried, saying that such couples are, quote, not excommunicated, and they absolutely must not be treated in that way, end quote. In the past, the Catholic Church leaders have condemned homosexual activity as a sin and said that gay marriage is a threat to global peace. Francis has said, quote, if someone is gay and searches for the Lord and has a good will, who am I to judge, end quote. Indeed. Now, he still vehemently opposes same-sex marriages, but there's a hint, just a hint, that he may be open to recognizing civil unions. For the past 1,000 years, popes have not allowed Catholic priests to marry. There's a rumor out there that the Pope, in private conversation, says he intends to overturn this ban on Catholic priests getting married. I'm sure there's a lot of priests out there who are just holding their breath waiting. Apparently, he understands that a celibate life is not necessary to serve as a priest. Again, this is not in the New Testament. This is something that was invented 1,000 years after Jesus walked on the earth. The Pope thinks God made everyone to live in a family, including priests, apparently. I think these are all good and exciting changes. However, it's the Pope's June 18th letter on climate change that makes me so happy about his religious leadership. Francis' extraordinary statement explains how humans are causing global warming. It refers to the science that shows that greenhouse gases from fossil fuels cause climate change. The encyclical concedes that factors such as solar cycles may also play a role, but the document pins most of global warming on human activity. The Pope has based his comments on accurate science as well as on his faith. He says that sea level rise and droughts associated with climate change will inflict the greatest suffering on the world's poorest, while the world's rich enjoy a comfortable lifestyle supported largely by fossil fuels. And then he goes on to say something that we will just ignore here in Florida. He says that the wealthy have the advantage of air conditioning and that we should turn that off because that's being produced by fossil fuels. I can hear it running in the background. And it gives us this wonderful feeling of being cool and comfortable, but it's destroying our atmosphere. He's very much against air conditioning. He intends this letter to influence the thinking and behavior of the world's 1.1 billion Catholics. My hope is that it will influence the United States Congress, where 30% of the members say that they are Roman Catholic. I also hope it will influence the United Nations climate talks that will take place in Paris this December. At these talks, delegates from 200 countries hope to complete a treaty to cut pollution linked to climate change. Never before has a pope made the environment the subject of an authoritative document meant to inspire university classes and Sunday sermons. Other religious leaders have spoken out on climate change. but the Pope is the leader of the largest organized religion in the world. The encyclical condemns modern materialism, warning that the stubborn adherence by a small fraction of the world's population to a consumerist lifestyle, he's talking about us now, can only lead to violence and mutual destruction. He says today's market-driven modern economies have devastated the planet, leaving it an immense pile of filth. Speaking these truths to Congress, to our Congress, and to the United Nations, will not make Pope Francis popular. In the United States, after the encyclical was published, the Pope's favorability rating dropped by 20 points, from 76% to 59%. Still, after living through a brutal military dictatorship in Argentina, I think he can stand up to folks like the climate change deniers in our own Congress. When he encourages our nation to act on global warming, when he does this week, I will be cheering him on. It will be crowded and chaotic in Washington, in New York, and Philadelphia. Federal employees have been told to treat Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday as snow days. They're encouraged to take their computers, their laptops home, and work at home, and not travel into Washington. In New York City, they are calling the visit a holy traffic nightmare. The Pope's visit will cause the largest street shutdown in New York City's history. In Philadelphia, police are already preparing for the visit, which won't take place in Philadelphia till Saturday, by closing some streets. They expect to welcome between 1 and 2 million people in Philadelphia who will come to see the Pope on Saturday. People flock to see him. The Pope symbolizes a life dedicated to discovering the core of meaning around which we can structure our time on earth. He symbolizes the desire to discover the religious, the spiritual dimensions in life. Now, I am not, nor will I ever be, a Roman Catholic. Nevertheless, I respect this desire, and I admire and honor its visible manifestation in these huge crowds that will turn out this week to see the Pope. Their commitment, their interest, it moves me. It's a good, positive religious impulse. But most important, it's his moral stand on climate change that gives me hope for our future.